Thank you for downloading this episode in the Harm Reduction Coalition podcast series. This past week, I was down in Bogota, Colombia, with a bunch of people from civil society, including my old friend Donald McPherson from the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. And we were at an Organization of American States meeting. It was the Inter-American Drug Abuse Control Commission. It's the drug committee, basically, of the Organization of American States. And given all the stuff that's happening in the Americas right now, we thought it was a good time to check out the meeting. And we had quite a long conversation, a reflective conversation on what our thoughts were on the CCAD meeting, on drugs in general, on the approach that the members of CCAD were taking, and et cetera. And I guess we got into global drug policy as well. So this is our conversation. Hi, Donald.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. We are at the Inter-American Drug Abuse Control Commission. That's probably not the way it's said. The Inter-American Drug Abuse Control Commission, CCAD, which is it's a part of the Organization of American States, the OAS. And we are here in Bogota. And it's the first time I've been to a CCAD meeting, and it's the first time you've been to a CCAD meeting, isn't it? And we're both veterans of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs meetings, and this is sort of a variation on that theme: government diplomats talking about drugs, because the OAS has been talking about drugs quite a lot in the last couple of years, which is what has made them interesting. So there's a lot of drug stuff going on in the Americas. So what's your thoughts on your first trip to a CCAT meeting?
Well, it's an interesting meeting. I must admit, I didn't know much about the OAS or CCAD up until a couple of years ago. Canada apparently plays a funder role, but we don't really hear about it back home. And but since the Summit of the Americas, where the the president of Colombia, Santos, pushed for a dialogue on the drug problems in this hemisphere, and successfully got commitment from the leaders of the OAS to engage in a discussion over time of drug policy issues. It seems that the OAS has made headlines. They've become energized. There's a lot of energy around the discussion, partly because in some of the countries of the OAS, like Mexico and El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, the death toll from the war on drugs and the drug cartels and the loss of territory in their countries has been devastating, and there's a sense that, at least in the Latin American countries, that they're fed up, and they want to engage in this dialogue. A few years ago, as you know, it was very difficult to raise these issues in any political forum, any multilateral political forum. It was sort of verboten to question the war on drugs.
It hasn't really come up, apart from Bolivia a little bit. At Commission on Narcotic Drugs.
That's right. And the tension, even when someone gets close to raising these issues at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, is immense. But with the OAS, it seems that they've opened the box, and they're talking. And they're also forced into it because of regional developments, mm-hmm. such as the regulation of cannabis votes in the U.S., Colorado State and Washington State, legalizing cannabis for adult use this past year, and Uruguay, which yesterday, the 10th of December, passed a bill in their Senate that would create a legal regulated market for adult use in Uruguay. So maybe that's why it's happening. And also the failure, I think the admitted failure that's coming out more and more from the U.S. that their version of the war on drugs has not worked, and they're beginning to look at more of a public health strategy.
Yeah, and I guess there's a little bit of cart and horse, like Uruguay. I'm not sure that Uruguay has legalized cannabis because of the OAS, or Washington, Colorado, because of anything happening around the OAS. But they feed off each other really nicely. And it's interesting. I mean, this meeting has all been about public health. It's been a response to the reports that came out. There's a, we'll talk about that in a minute, the analytic report and the scenarios planning report. So this meeting is a, you know, has been shaped around moving the debate forward in away from prohibition or a punitive approach to drugs, and to talk about public health. So it's been, I guess in theory it's interesting, but sitting in these rooms you realize it's a bunch of people that are all over the place. I mean, they're moving forward by default. They're not moving forward because they're skilled, educated people around drugs. They're a disaster, a lot of these people. It's contradictory. It's bizarre. And maybe we'll get to that in a minute. But one of the things that I've been, since I've sort of, you know, dropped into this process over the last year, is in Salsa, the head of the OAS. He has got really buoyed and excited about the response from these reports and is really like riding that wave. And he spoke today and he sounded really gung-ho and good. And it seems like OAS is a driving force behind this more than some like the UNODC is a driving force behind CND.
Yes, I agree. And Salsa is energized and has been energized by this. And I don't know enough to know what that's all about. He was clearly energized today and was pushing very hard for countries to be open-minded and enter into dialogue and consider alternatives and actually subtly or not so subtly reprimanded statements that were categorical, like we oppose this or we oppose that.
Yeah.
Which surprised and probably upset some of the delegations. And this is within the OAS, which up until 2012 was not known as for taking sort of the strong leadership on this issue at all. If anything, it was more trying to contain the policy discussion to the same old.
Yeah.
So there's something happening, and I think it's a loosening of control that the U.S. sort of policy apparatus has had on the Latin American countries, the emergence of more stronger Latin American leaders. Mm-hmm. There's something going on, and you know it could all change with change in political leadership. Politicians come and go, and we may lose some of those strong voices. But I think what the complicating factors are what's going on in the U.S. Destruction or fall of cannabis prohibition globally is going to accelerate, in my opinion, in the U.S. And you know, California is going to regulate cannabis in a couple of years. There'll be other states bringing bills forward at the state level, so that will also impact the hemisphere. And so you have Uruguay in the southern cone doing what they're doing. You have various states in the U.S. moving. You know, if Mexico were to shift its policy, that would be a total game changer. And who knows if that'll ever happen? But it seems like there's beginning to be a lot in play here.
And I also think the fact that Obama is president has an impact, because he's not someone who's going to ride over in the same way as a Republican president would have done. And that was acknowledged in a sort of forceful way by one of the speakers yesterday, who was sitting next to Michael Botticelli, the deputy drug czar, who was chairing the session. And it was someone from Colombia, I think. I don't think it was, actually it might have been a religious person, wasn't it? I don't know.
It's an academic.
Yeah, an academic. Yep. Yeah, he said 5 years ago we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. The US would be a completely different character at these meetings, basically. But his tone was actually quite bitter about what has gone on in the past around American control of the hemisphere. And I think that's part of it too. It's like it's coming out from under the US's thumb.
And I think you could feel some of that resentment in the room today as well. Mm-hmm. I think the ethos in Latin America is, you know, welcoming support and help from all quarters, but not just doing what they're told by the U.S. around drug policy. So the OA, this process, I think, has helped. It's helped to formalize a discussion that was already beginning to happen mm-hmm. informally.
Yeah.
And it's energized some of those countries that that see when they speak out. They get support from various global partners mm-hmm. In Europe, in other parts of the world, who also agree that we need to open the dialogue, an alternative to the war on drugs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the agenda is agreed by the co-chairs or the chairs of OAS, right? But the fact that Nuno Capaz is here from the, I think he's deputy of the dissuasion committees in Portugal, talking about decriminalization in Portugal, you know, on the panel on alternative approaches to the war on drugs, you know, that's a signal right there. And the fact that he actually got on the agenda is good. And a lot of the speakers were very good, talking about human rights as well. But then the responses, you know, what I was saying before about the all-over-the-place responses, Nuno would speak about decriminalization, it is not legalization, it's decriminalization that we've done. And then the people in the audience would go, we're not going to legalize. Like, no one has talked about legalization in these meetings. The only people talking about it are those people saying we're never going to legalize. Or a response around human rights. I can't remember what it was. Do you remember? It was, might have been Nicaragua. It was Nicaragua saying, well, we're not going to protect the right human rights of a minority and give up the human rights of the majority of the people who don't use drugs.
As if it's an either or.
Yeah, exactly.
Surely you can protect the human rights of all of your citizens, even those who use drugs. I mean, isn't that the whole point of... you know, that should be the point of the public health approach.
Yeah, and actually the concept of human rights dialogue is that human rights are for everyone. And the reason why we're talking about having it for human rights of drug users is because they're a population that often have their rights taken away from them. So it's not giving human rights to a group and taking it away from another, it's expanding human rights to everyone. And someone did say in the room, which was sort of, on first hearing was sort of messed up, but actually it was an accurate statement that people in this room have different definitions of what human rights are.
Yes, and there was a fellow on one of the panels today. He was at our side. That
yeah,
society event.
Preemie?
Was he? And then he was basically talking about, you know, human rights. I mean, and the session was about public health and human rights the whole day today. And talking about, you know, human rights really trumping all other mm-hmm. treaties. You know, the treaties around human rights trumping drug control treaties, in the sense that if you're taking the rights of people away through your approach to drug control, then that's not on. That shouldn't be on, because you cannot meet your obligations under the human rights treaties mm-hmm. that you've already signed. And
right.
I think, I'm not sure if that's one of Uruguay's arguments for, you know, legalizing cannabis, but they do talk in a profound way about the human rights of their citizens as part of their thinking in mm-hmm. doing that. So I guess we'll see you in the international court, or we'll see you in court. I mean, what
right.
treaties trump which treaties, and we're about to explore that terrain as Uruguay moves forward, as the U.S. moves forward, and other countries consider these options.
Did the U.S. Did you catch this? I mean, didn't catch it, but the U.S. Actually said we do not support legalizing any drug today.
I believe that's what they said.
Yeah,
yeah, they do not. Yes, they do not support legalizing. And these were comments made as sort of peremptory mm-hmm. comments.
Yeah.
Canada was even stronger on the statement, I think, than the U.S. They were very clear that they were putting their position out, really, which was sort of unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing going to happen in the next few days. They could have embraced the notion of dialogue
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
Discussion. But Canada and the U.S. were the two countries that made it very clear that they are against any legalization of any drugs.
Yeah, you must have. How does it feel to be humiliated by your government? It's not. It's a new kind of feeling for you, isn't it?
It is. It is. Canada used to be a leader in this field, a leader in public health, progressive in drug policy, used to convene like-minded countries before the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, had some very good bureaucrats, senior bureaucrats who were interested in moving more toward the public health approach many, many years ago, long before this recent rhetoric around public health, which, to your point, you know, everyone's talking about public health. But they're, what are they doing? Are they're either sustaining and maintaining programs that are harmful from a public health point of view, or not moving in that direction at all. But their rhetoric's changed, and that's a big, that's a big part of the, I think, the problem with the U.S. is that, you know, their rhetoric is getting really good, and it sounds great, and it's refreshing to hear, but you know what. They still won't talk about harm reduction. It's too scary for them.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's scary. If there's 70 or 80 or 90 countries in the world that has harm reduction in their drug policy frameworks. So there's a disconnect there as well that you notice when you talk to your delegates in the hallway and then you hear what they say officially on the record.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a disconnect there, or a lot of a disconnect.
Absolutely. The highlight of what the U.S. is promoting here is drug courts. The public health response to drugs is drug courts, and you know it's. And then this is what's interesting to me too. It's like you could rip the argument apart, and no one does. Actually, apart from Nuno, did challenge them a bit on the drug courts. But it's like the basic argument from the U.S. is we understand that. Drug use is not a moral issue. The science is in. It's clear that drug use is a disease, and therefore we should now have you before a judge for your disease, and if you relapse, we will punish you for your disease, and it's that's going to help you get better. And it's just such a weird train of thought.
Well, I see it as a, you know, a distraction from really thinking through what a real public health approach would look like. And so if the drug court energy sort of, I mean, they argue that, you know, well, it's better than, it's an alternative to incarceration. Mm-hmm. But it's such a small incremental approach to a real public health approach. That's where the energy should be going.
Yeah.
If you got to walk the talk of, if you want to do a public health approach, what does it mean? Well, it means robust, low-threshold programs. It means being able to say the words that have been accepted in medicine for 100 years, harm reduction. Mm-hmm. It means embracing the full extent of what a public health approach might look like, and not getting stuck in this tiny, incremental scenario where drug courts are one of the main issues. Maybe it's because they're really concrete. Every country has a court, every country has enforcement, every country has people who use drugs, and they're easy to do. And who knows, maybe some people benefit from them. But in terms of bang for buck resources, you won't ever build a public health infrastructure if you get stuck at the drug court level.
Yeah.
So, I'm not an expert in drug courts. It's obvious that, you know, I'm uncomfortable with them. I'm uncomfortable with the court models where you have to plead guilty before you get into them, into the treatment side of it. And I think they're a distraction. I think they take a lot of energy and resources to put together, and the results, at least in Canada, you know, they're profound for some individuals. We saw a video of a mother who's son had been through, or daughter had been through a drug court in one of these countries.
The Dominican Republic.
Yeah. Well, you could go back to New York and you could interview a mother whose kid was saved by discovering a syringe exchange in New York.
Yeah, totally.
Or I could go back to Vancouver and find a mother whose daughter had been saved by attending the Vancouver supervised injection site. We could all produce those videos.
You can find someone who was grateful they went to prison for a long time.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Best thing that ever happened to me was getting hit by that car.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
When I was, you know, high, and I ended up in the hospital.
Yeah.
And I I'm not paralyzed, but I'm not using drugs. I mean, you can construct these stories with nearly any intervention, and that's sort of the danger in overselling what a drug court is, and distracting. We should be helping the U.S. and Canada, because we have strong public health infrastructures. We should be helping countries identify the full range of public health. Mm-hmm. Scope and capacity, yeah. and interventions.
Along those lines, we had a sort of a side meeting with the guy who's basically the equivalent of a drug czar in Ecuador, and it was quite a refreshing conversation, because you get the sense he said he was from the business world, he got invited into government, thought he would do something in the commercial end of government, and they gave him drugs as his portfolio, and to my mind, he didn't say this. He sort of looked at this with a fresh set of eyes and said, there are reasons why people use drugs, let's address them. And he's done, I can't remember how many it was, he's done like 100 and something communities that they've been to. They have developed some community-driven interventions which are not about drugs per se, but they're about building some economic infrastructure, they're about education, they're about healthcare, addressing some of those underlying causes, which was a really refreshing thing to hear from a minister.
I think that's the good example to your earlier comment about the diversity in the discussion today. And I think people like him come in, you know, they're smart people. They come in with fresh eyes. They don't have a lot of baggage around, you know, the being involved in this drug war stuff for 30 years or 20 years or whatever. And they have the fresh approach, and they're open to new ideas. He was very, mm-hmm. He said, "Look, I want to find out what's working internationally. Yeah. I want to talk to you guys. I want to talk to other people in other jurisdictions. I want to find out," and that's really refreshing. And then you have other folks who've been hammering away in an isolated fashion in a small or large country, mm-hmm. in a locality, and have not had the time, energy, capacity to see that there, you know, this is 2013. There's a whole lot of new thinking around how to address these problems. So it's frustrating to sort of see, and I guess this is what, you know, the multilateral work is, you know, how do you build consensus across the hemisphere when you have such a variation in knowledge and skills, mm-hmm. and capacity to even learn what are the successful innovations and changes that are possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we should just go back to those reports a second.
Right.
And there were two reports that were commissioned. One was basically a general state of drugs in the hemisphere. So an analytic report that looked at everything from public health to crime, violence, probably money laundering, you know, rates of use. And then there was this thing called the scenarios planning report, and it came up with four scenarios, and you were part of that process. Do you want to explain what it is, how it worked, and what the outcome was?
Yes, the commitment to do the analytical report came out of the 2012 Summit of the Americas, as well as to an agreement to undergo a more creative process to come up with scenarios of what could happen over the next 15 years. And the OAS hired a consultant named Adam Kahane, who does this. This is what he does. He brings diverse groups of people together to struggle with intractable social issues and social problems. And there's a design, it's a non-linear process. There were people from not all of the countries, quite a few of the countries in the hemisphere. There were a couple from Canada, a few from the States, and a sprinkling. You know, there was more Latin Americans, of course, than anyone, any other group. And we came together and went through a process over a period of 2 one-week sessions. And the meetings were in Panama. And diverse participation from NGOs to former generals in the Colombian military to heads of police in Nicaragua to drug treatment court judge from San Jose, California. Mm-hmm. So very, very interesting crowd. Mostly, I would say mostly people who were off. I won't speculate.
Well, I mean, I think if I'm guessing what you're saying, it wasn't exactly like there were. It was crowded with drug policy reform people. There was maybe 4 or 5 people that would fall into that category out of the whole bunch.
Out of the 46, mm-hmm. there were, you know, there was some attempt to include some people who are out there on the fact that we need change.
Yeah.
And, you know, there actually were others in the group that were not publicly out there, but they did not disagree with the need for change.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. the consensus across the group was, there was consensus that things need to change,
yeah.
you know, and how, that's where the scenarios come into play.
Right.
So,
which I think you're saying this wasn't a biased project to begin with. It was something that the consensus through the conversation came together and said that the change is in the works.
Yeah, part of the methodology is to try and get people that represent the range of positions or starting positions. So, you know, you had to have a few people who were calling for change there. And you had some folks who were some of the policing folks. But again, they weren't not calling for change, but they, you know, a lot of people were clearly not going to mess with the international treaties.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, okay, let's change, but let's change within the box of the international mm-hmm. treaties. And there were some of us who were saying, well, I think that we think the treaties should be, yes, we should look at change, but we also should say, are there international treaties constraining where we have to go in terms of finding new ways to address these issues? So that was very interesting. It was interesting watching, given that everyone was wanting some form of change, watching how that played out in the scenarios was interesting. And so we worked for 2 weeks, and then we wrote, we all had input into all of the scenarios. So there were 2 1-week meetings, and then there was a big long period of about 6 weeks of drafting these scenarios. And we all participated in that. So you came out with 4 scenarios. One of them was called Together. And it was the essence of that one was, if we all work together, sort of together we can do it, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's very much like that. If we all work together and we got better at working together and we shared more information and we cooperated more across the hemisphere, we would get better at identifying the truly violent people and cartels, and we would get better at, you know, sharing information, delivering services for people with drug problems and all that sort of stuff. The second scenario was one called Pathways, which was acknowledging that the world is changing, that countries are beginning to look at different ways of going. You can look at, you know, Bolivia, who stepped out of the treaties because of the coca leaf issue, coca leaf being considered the same as cocaine in the international treaties, the Uruguay moving in a certain direction. The votes in the U.S. So it was clear that the citizens of some countries and the politicians of other countries are moving in different directions. So that became one of the scenarios, that countries go their own way, and how the tension created in the international treaties around that is resolved or not resolved was part of the scenario discussion. The third scenario was one called Resilience, which was driven by a few of us, mostly the Latin American, some Latin American countries, who felt that, you know, well, drugs really aren't the problem. Drugs are a symptom. They're a symptom of drug problems in other parts of the world. And, you know, we live with the production and transit. It's not really, you know, the problem. That's a different problem. We don't have a big substance use problem in our countries. We have poverty, poor economic development, and all those other sorts of things that's where our energy should be going to, creating healthier communities. And by doing that, you would, one, protect your families and young people from falling into problematic drug use. And two, you would it's sort of like a large prevention program. The weakness in that scenario is it didn't even address the problem of the drug problem in another part of the world driving
right,
the production
yeah,
and transit. Yeah. And so it struggled with that, but it really wanted to put the focus of it on social economic development.
Yeah.
The third scenario was nothing changes. It continues to, and if nothing changes, things continue to deteriorate. And this was driven in large part by some Central American folks who basically feel they're transit countries. They don't really have a drug problem. And if nothing changes to help them with their issues around the violence and the death toll around the war on drugs and the war on the cartels that impact their residents, their citizens, you know, the scenario is that they just start to cut deals with the cartels and say, look, you know, we don't want to lose lives over you guys transiting cocaine through our country, so fly at it and leave us alone, and we'll address our own community issues, but we don't want a drug war going on in our country because of the lack of movement or lack of resolution on these big issues.
Yeah, I mean, so, and then, as we said, that these reports were released and got a lot of attention for developing these scenarios. And I was, around the time they came out, which was in spring of this year, wasn't it?
May
2013. There was another meeting down here that Mark Kleiman, the drug, you know, more mainstream drug policy guy, was at. And he was talking on NPR in the States about how actually, you know, even though people want to figure out how to, you know, change things up, there was actually no roadmap. Mm-hmm. And actually now there is for all those different scenarios, whichever way you could go. And reading them, you also think that you could do hybrid versions of them.
Yeah.
You really want to do economic development in places as well as, you know, take some of the criminality out of drug problems or drug issues. Now this we're here, but there's a sort of a timeline going on, isn't there? One of the reasons why some of the way I look at why the public health stuff was on this agenda here in the way it was, that there will be another one of these meetings, CCAD meetings, in May, I think, and then later in the year, and it's not decided when yet, there will be a full hemispheric discussion of drugs, and this all ties into the 2016 big meeting in New York on drugs at the UN, the drugs on gas. And so the two processes, you got the UN process and you got the OAS process, and they're tying into each other. And it makes this whole multilateral thing a really interesting, dynamic sort of enterprise, I guess, as we go forward to 2016, because now the public health discussion has taken place here. There will be discussion on drugs. There will be discussion at CND on developments. Uruguay has changed. Stuff in the US is changing things, and it can't really be ignored. So the fact that these things are on record now means that in the discussion in 2016 in New York, these discussions have already started. It won't be that they have to start from zero. The change discussions have already started globally. So it's fascinating.
It is. And I think that brings a couple of things to mind. Like today, you know, you can see something in The Guardian that the Home Office is going to study how to approach or whether they should consider regulating some of these new psychoactive substances that are being, you know, invented every day and produced in Asia, apparently. That's the New Zealand model that New Zealand implemented. So if you look at globally, like every day, it's sort of like my sort of there's a collapse of the system, and it's not necessarily the treaties are going to all fall apart, but there's a collapse of a way of thinking, and there's an energy around some of these new innovations that are happening, and an interest, and so by 2016. There could be several more countries that are vigorously talking about different approaches, whether it's harm reduction approaches or regulatory approaches. It's sort of like the horses left the barn, and it's not going to stop. And you heard today a couple of comments by some delegations that look, we're spending way too much time talking on this. Why don't we just get down to business and implement a public health approach?
Yeah,
we can do it. And it's very much of let's just work harder together, and we can do it. But we won't change anything structurally, like the laws, and we'll tinker away, and I think there's a lot of resistance to that. But I think that's going to play out over the next few years, and it's going to take time. But the horses left the barn, the trains left the station. If we start seeing positive results, and we already have, look, Portugal, 10 or more years of decriminalization and of smart decriminalization, intentional. Integrated decrim with some public health thinking.
Were they actually? I mean, I talked to Nuno about this today. It wasn't just decriminalization per se. That there was a whole process that went into. They revamped their prevention messages. They revamped policing. They revamped drug treatment. They put money into it, and they amped up the harm reduction stuff. They got really smart on drugs. And so there was a whole process which everyone should be learning from, as opposed to like picking little things. It's like you do the whole thing is part of a continuum.
Yeah, I think the bill that went to their parliament was had 98 recommendations in it. So it was a very thoughtful piece of work. It wasn't just removing criminal sanctions for less than 30 grams of cannabis or something like that. It was which those regimes have been implemented since the 70s in Australia and the US, but they which is a good thing. But this was a really thoughtful piece of work, and it seems to be sustaining itself even during an economic recession, a huge economic recession in Portugal. So you have those. You'll have data from Colorado and Washington and Uruguay. You have the 40 years of legal access to cannabis from Holland. You could put this list of drug policy innovations, 10 years of insight in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And nothing bad has happened with any of those innovations.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, some good things have happened.
Yeah.
So the list is growing, and that's sort of what, if I got to speak to this group tomorrow for 5 minutes, that's sort of what I'd say. I'd say, look at this list of things. And so what's the fear of change? I mean, this should be an exhilarating time.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the edge of some new opportunities to eliminate or reduce harm, reduce violence. What's the fear here? It just seems like we're not quite there yet. There's a lot of resistance, a lot of the trouble with these diplomatic meetings is that the diplomats are talking.
Yeah.
And if they're really well informed, which usually they're not, because they have political masters. And I know our delegation isn't. They're not talking much about science or evidence, and we have brilliant scientists in Canada who could provide them with that stuff. And it just seems that the diplomats have differing levels of understanding of the complexity of this issue. It's a difficult issue, so that makes it hard from the get-go to have a good conversation, because it's so complex and you can go in so many different directions.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We should wrap this up, I guess. But it's one of the panelists said today, there's no such thing as good drugs or bad drugs, and someone in the audience said, actually, yes, there is. We make the bad drugs illegal. That's why they're illegal, and it's a basic not understanding what the issue is, and that's why I said at the beginning, you wonder how we're making tremendous progress in certain ways, and you wonder how how is it that it's. I don't know. It's like fixing a complicated piece of machinery being fixed by a bunch of people who are not mechanics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I've been there in Vancouver in 1998. We had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who had died from overdoses. We had an HIV epidemic. We had an injection drug use epidemic. And, we all thought, well, surely we have the body count for a robust and timely response to a public health emergency, which had been declared by our local health authority. 6 years later. It took 6 years, and some would argue 8 or 10, some would argue longer. It took that long to open up a tiny little supervised injection
Yeah.
site that, does lots of work. It's the only one we have that's sanctioned in Canada. And it was 6 years of hard work by people at all levels of the community, the city, the province. And so it's like, how many more people have to die before you do something different?
And but I think let's end on a positive note. We think there is something different happening. It's hard to watch it move. Thank you very much, Donald.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. And if all goes well, we actually will be back next week with our next podcast. See you then.